maybe you can hear me without this.
Welcome to Anthropology and Social Change events. Can everybody hear me?
Yes?
Not really. Can you do something with this thing?
Turn it on.
Well, let me use this one. I went here at CIIS. And, you know, we are really super excited to welcome John Holloway tonight. John was, there's so many ways to introduce John. One way is to say that he's a professor. And this is probably the most boring way that doesn't do any justice. He has been doing so many things and influencing so many people, myself included, over the last couple of decades, ever since he got involved with what was known as state derivationist debate, and then open Marxism, and then finally with Chiapas and the uprising in Chiapas with the Zapatistas, providing some of the most insightful and most important rethinking or element, basis for rethinking of what revolution is, what capitalism is, what all of these social relations that strangle us, as John is going to explain a little bit later. He provided, it's definitely not a blueprint, Changing the World Without Taking Power. This book was so powerful that it incited an extremely important debate. Many of us were in agreement with John, and we were trying to say, yes, in order to take the power, in order to change the world, you actually don't need to take the power of the state. This had become a huge debate within the left, on the left, within the left, and it created, I think it advanced the debates on the anti-capitalist left to an extraordinarily important degree. Also, when we were thinking about this program, when we were planning it, it's actually hard to do this, you will forgive me. When we were thinking about actually doing... When we were thinking about creating this department... Thinking about creating a department that is actually about post-capitalist studies and study in many ways of cracks. I started communicating with John about the ways, thinking together about the ways of doing it. And John's advice in how to think through the political issues behind this idea of creating a program that is within a private school, but is at the same time anti-capitalist and post-capitalist, has been truly, truly something that I'm very grateful for. And I'm so happy to see so many of our students here. Thank you for coming and thank you for making this possible. John is our first visiting activist scholar. And this three talks, because John is gonna be giving three talks, one tonight, the other one tomorrow, and the last one on Thursday, on different topics. These three talks are going to become a book that we are going to be publishing with PM Press. So that's another beautiful thing that I'm very happy to announce today. So again, welcome and welcome, John Holloway.
Hello. Good evening. Sorry, I've just been causing problems here about the podium and where to sit and things like that. Because the podium I thought was too formal. And then I thought, well, I could sit on a chair, but chair was really too horizontal. Horizontalism may be good in principle, but in practice, I prefer to be a little bit above everybody else. Or in other words, I get nervous if I don't see you. It's very exciting to be here. What I heard from Annie and Andre about the center here, about the institute, and about what you're doing, makes it sound an extremely, extremely exciting place. And it's really an honor to be here, and it's really exciting to think that we're going to have 3 days together, or at least I'm going to have 3 days together. I hope some of you will as well. I always get nervous whenever I come to a new place. I always feel kind of slightly nervous because I'm not quite sure where you are. I mean, I've got a rough idea, I suppose, of where I am, but I'm never quite sure where everybody else is. And this is, in fact, only the third time that I've ever come to speak in the evil empire itself. So I feel it's kind of slightly, it's kind of a process of exploration. It's a process really by which I hope we'll be able to find one another over the next few days. But it may well be that what I say is just pushing through open doors, or it may well be that what I say is absolutely, totally incomprehensible or just irrelevant. So if you want to interrupt me or boo or applaud wildly from time to time, then please feel free to do so. I know roughly where I want to go. We've got three sessions. Okay. What I want to say, I think, at the end is we are the crisis of the capital and proud of it. And it seems to me that that is actually fundamentally important politically. But that's at the end. I'm not going to get there this evening. What I want to do this evening is just to start, and to start at the beginning. And if I say where I want to go is we are the crisis of capital, then clearly the beginning is we. And what I want to talk about is simply that. What I want to talk about is we. We, because I think the starting point is very important. Where we start talking, or where we start a conversation, or where we start writing an essay, or where we start writing a thesis, really has a fundamental effect on what follows. And the great tradition, the great Marxist tradition certainly, is to start with, not with we, not with us, but with them, with capital. With talking about capitalist domination and the changing forms of capitalist domination. And that seems to me absolutely disastrous. It seems to me disastrous because I think that what happens is that the starting point locks us in. That if we start from capital, what we then go on to do is to try and elaborate a theory of domination. And by elaborating a theory of domination, we are actually closing ourselves in. And there's a great tradition on the left, isn't it? A great tradition to say, well, if we talk about domination in this beautiful, free, liberal society we live in, if we say, well, it's not really a free and liberal society, it's really a society based on capitalist domination. And the great tradition is that if we say that is in some way progressive, that we're kind of moving forward in some way. And I think that's not true at all. I think it's not true at all, partly for two reasons, I think. Firstly, because it's perfectly obvious. It's perfectly obvious that we live in a society based on domination. It's perfectly obvious that we live in a nasty, oppressive, capitalist society. That's not really the problem. That's kind of a kind of pre-scientific statement. It's really after that the problem starts. It's after that you have to start thinking. It's after that you have to start thinking, fine, of course we do, but how on earth do we get out of it? And that's really the issue, I think. So I think that the danger is that if we start with domination, we actually lock ourselves in. We lock ourselves into elaborating a theory of domination, and we kind of set the framework within which we ourselves think. so that we first elaborate the theory of domination, and then afterwards we start to talk about social struggle or class struggle. And I don't think that works. So I don't want to start from that. I don't want to start from the nasties. I want to start from us, who are lovely. And really to start from the question, okay, well, we could start, of course, from the working class. We could say, well, we are the proletariat, we are the working class. But I'm not going to do that either, at least not for the moment. Maybe we'll get to it. I'm not going to do it for the moment because, firstly, because it seems to me formulaic, if that's the word, that it kind of leads us into thinking in terms of formulas. That if we start with saying, well, okay, we have to break capitalism, obviously, no? But therefore we have to start from the working class, who are us. Then I think we get into to old formulas, and the old formulas, I think, don't work. So I want to come back to the question of the working class, but not actually to start from there. The other great danger about talking about starting from the working class is that it very easily or very quickly becomes a third-person discourse. You know, that we start thinking about the working class as they. And there the whole revolutionary, certainly the whole Leninist tradition, I think, thinks of the working class as a they. You know, they are the revolutionary subject. How can we think about realizing the revolutionary potential of a them? You know? And I think the problem isn't. The problem, if you start thinking about them, then you start getting into a politics that treats the them as an object in some way. You start getting into a politics of thinking on behalf of the them. Anyway, we can come back to that as well. It doesn't really matter. What I want to say is, want to start with us. Okay. And who are we? Or what does we mean? And I think it's also important because I think there's a shift. I suppose partly what I hope we'll be talking about in these three sessions is really a shift in the grammar of anti-capitalism. A shift in the way we think about anti-capitalism, and a shift in the way we act, well, in the forms of anti-capitalist action. And I think one of the things that is happening is one of the aspects of that change of grammar is that anti-capitalist movements more and more are talking about themselves as we. They don't talk so much about the working class or the downtrodden or the marginalized or whatever. It seems to me that more and more the key figure is we. And if we ask, well, who is we? Who, or if we want to be a little bit more grammatical and say, who are we? Then we come quickly to the idea that we are a question. We don't actually know very well. It's not a predefined category. It's an open we. It's a we that invites. It's a we that provokes. It's a we that asks. And if we ask, well, who are we? Who are we? We can say we, well, the title of these talks is After Capitalism. No? And I suppose I'm not quite sure, to be honest, I'm not quite sure what After Capitalism means. But I suppose it means, in the first place, anti-capitalism. So I suppose that we could perhaps say that most of us, or probably all of us here, are anti-capitalist. And then we can ask, well, why are we anti-capitalist? And I think until about 3 days ago, I thought the answer is obvious. I thought, well, of course, we're anti-capitalist because capitalism stinks. We're anti-capitalism, capitalist because capitalism is a disaster for humanity. We're anti-capitalist because if we don't break capitalism, if we don't change the system in some way, then it is very likely that the dynamic of this system will lead to the total destruction of humanity. Of course we're anti-capitalist. But there's kind of, it struck me then that there's one little step missing in that argument. Because, you see, if you think of bees, if you think, well, okay, capitalism is a disastrous system, it's an authoritarian system, it's a horrible system. Therefore, we are against it. But then you begin to think of bees, or you begin to think of ants. And you might think, okay, bees and ants, they live in a horrible authoritarian system as well, where everything is predefined, you know, where there is a hierarchy. But at least as far as I know, bees and ants don't rebel against the hierarchy in their hives or in their nests. Okay, so it doesn't follow automatically from the fact that the system is nasty, that therefore we are rising up against it. The link, the point that's missing is that there must be something to distinguish. And it's not that I have anything against bees or ants at all. I mean, I really hold them in a lot of respect, but there must be something else. We must be different in some way from bees and ants. And I suppose that leads us to the first point I want to suggest. And the answer is, okay, I'm going to suggest. We don't know, we is a question, but we have enough experience to suggest answers that are also questions or perhaps provocations. Okay, so the first thing, I suppose, what distinguishes us from ants and bees is that we are dignity. We revolt, we rebel against the negation of our dignity. And you probably know, I'm going to quote, because it's one of my favorite quotes, and you probably all know it, so you should all know it off by heart and be able to quote it without thinking, but all the same, I'm going to quote it just because it's so beautiful. From one of the early Zapatista letters, in fact, a letter from the Zapatista clandestine, the committee to another indigenous organization, written right at the start of the uprising, just at the end of January 1994, in which they explain their why they rose up. And they say, then that suffering that united us made us speak, and we recognized that in our words there was truth. We knew that not only pain and suffering lived in our tongue, we recognized that there is hope still in our hearts. We spoke with ourselves, we looked inside ourselves, and we looked at our history. We saw our most ancient fathers suffering and struggling. We saw our grandfathers struggling. We saw our fathers with fury in their hands. We saw that not everything had been taken away from us, that we had the most valuable, that which made us live, that which made our step rise above plants and animals, that which made the stone be beneath our feet. And we saw, brothers, that all that we had was dignity. And we saw that great was the shame of having forgotten it. And we saw that dignity was good for men to be men again, and dignity returned to live in our hearts, and we were new again. And the dead, our dead, saw that we were new again, and they called us again to dignity, to struggle. So if we're anti-capitalist, it's not just that capitalism stinks, it's also that we're saying something about ourselves. It's also saying that we have dignity, or we are dignity. To say we are dignified in English doesn't sound right, so let's say we are dignity. No. We are dignity, and therefore we will not accept. Therefore we will not accept the world that we are born into. Therefore we will not accept this world of destruction, this world of disaster. We are dignity, but we are not just dignity. Obviously, the fact that we will not accept, what we will not accept at the end of the day, is the negation of our own dignity. We will not accept. So dignity is negated, but it is not entirely negated, because if it were entirely negated, then it would be impossible for us to have a concept of dignity. Dignity is enraged. Our dignity is enraged, or the place from where we start, and I think it's probably the place from where we all start in this room, is the position of enraged dignity, of dignified furia, of digna rabia, as the Zapatistas call it. In other words, one way of thinking about dignity, there are lots of ways of thinking about dignity, but one way of dignity is just, here we are. You know, here we are as subjects. The world tells us that we are not here. The world tells us that we really don't matter. The world that we see on the television, the world that we read about in the papers, we are not there. We are the invisible. So the dignity is the invisible making themselves visible. Just the Zapatistas putting on their what you call the balaclavas, their ski helmets, so that they can be seen, covering their faces so that people can see them. So dignity is the dignity of the invisible. It is the dignity of the latent. The dignity of the latent, but the dignity of the latent that is in movement. So dignity is volcanic. It is that which moves beneath the surface. It is that which brings us here tonight. So we are not victims. That is surely the important point about dignity, is that when they talk about dignity, they're saying no. No way are we victims. We will not start from being victims. If we think of ourselves as being victims, then we are lost. If we start, this is something I wanted to say earlier but forgot, if we start from a world of domination, then we start by defining ourselves as victims, as being the bearers of the relations of domination. And it's not that. We are not victims. We are not victims. And we are not poor either. Okay, the great left tradition is, oh dear, poor us, we suffer so much. And it's not that. It's that. If we start from that, then we, in a way, we kill ourselves from the beginning. It's not that we are poor. That's not why we rise up. That's not why we protest. It's not because we're poor. It's because we're rich. And the starting point, surely, for our rebelliousness is not poverty, it is actually richness. And I think it's important to say that, perhaps. And Francis of Assisi has been back in the news over the last week or so now, the new Pope. And Hart and Negri also, in their first book, was it the first book, have this section on Francis of Assisi that always seemed to me a peculiar provocation. It's not that. It's not that we start off from being poor. We start off from being rich. And Marx, it seems to me, says that very clearly. If you think of capital, being rich, I've kind of been obsessed with over the last few weeks. If you think about capital, if you think of how capital starts, okay, the first sentence of capital is the wealth of those societies in which the capitalist mode of production prevails appears as an immense accumulation of commodities. And everybody says, I think literally without exception, that Marx starts its analysis from the commodity. And in fact, he doesn't. He starts, if you think of that first sentence, he starts off with the words, the wealth. He starts from our richness. He doesn't start from our defeat, from our depravity, from our deformation. He starts from our richness. And there's a beautiful passage, I'm going to quote that as well. I'm into quoting things this evening, sorry. There's a beautiful passage from the Grundrisse where Marx explains what he means by richness. Where he says, in fact, however, when the limited bourgeois form is stripped away, in other words, when the commodity form is stripped away, what is wealth other than the universality of human needs, capacities, pleasures, productive forces, etc., created through universal exchange? The absolute working out of man's creative potentialities with no presupposition other than the previous historical development, which makes this totality of development, that is, the development of all human powers as such, the end in itself, not as measured on a predetermined yardstick. Where he does not produce himself in one specificity, but produces his totality, strives not to remain something he has become, but is in the absolute movement of becoming. Which is just so beautiful. And that's where he starts from. He starts from this richness, which is then falls into this miserable pit of the commodity. No. And that's what it's all about. And then we read it and we think, oh yeah, we forget about the first bit of the sentence and we think, oh yes, he's starting with the commodity. He's not. And we do it ourselves. We start from domination and we think, yeah, that's what it's about. No, we shouldn't. Let's start from ourselves. Let's start from ourselves who are and from our own richness. We are the only gods. We are the only creators. We are the only creators, at least of our own society. We are the creators of the wealth on which capital depends. The lords always depend on their servants. The masters always depend on their slaves, and that is the source of hope. And one more quotation, which is also a favorite, and then that's going to be my last quotation, because that's enough. But this is a quotation from the 16th century French theorist, La Boétie, who says to the people, addressing the people, in his discourse on voluntary servitude, he says, you sow your crops in order that he, the Lord, may ravage them. You install and furnish your homes to give him goods to pillage. You rear your daughters that he may gratify his lust. You bring up your children in order that he may confer upon them the greatest privilege he knows, to be led into his battles, to be delivered to butchery, to be made the servants of his greed and the instruments of his vengeance. You yield your bodies unto hard labor in order that he may indulge in his delights and wallow in his filthy pleasures. You weaken yourselves in order to make him the stronger and the mightier to hold you in check. From all these indignities, such as the very beasts of the field would not endure, you can deliver yourselves if you try, not by taking action, but merely by willing to be free. Resolve to serve no more, and you are at once freed. I do not ask that you place hands upon the tyrant to topple him over, but simply that you support him no longer. Then you will behold him like a great colossus whose pedestal has been pulled away, fall of his own weight and break in pieces. Which is beautiful. Which is beautiful and sounds very simple, and perhaps it isn't so simple, but the point is basic, isn't it? The point is fundamental. The point is that the rulers always depend upon the ruled, and that is our strength and that is our hope. And that's just not, of course, it's not just La Boétie, that's also Hegel's argument, if you think of the master's servant dialectic. But also, it is Marx's argument, that is what the labor theory of value is about. I mean, the economists have kind of captured the labor theory of value and made us think that it is a theory about how the economy works. But the basic thing about the labor theory of value is, of course, to say that capital depends upon the value that is produced by the people it dominates. No? In other words, capital depends upon labor. We are the center of the world. We are the center of the world. We are the center of the world, and we are revolting. That's also why we're here tonight, I suppose, because we are revolting in one sense or another. And we are revolting. We are revolting because we are ordinary. That, as well, it seems to me, very important. We're revolting not because we're special, because obviously we could think, well, here we are tonight, what are we, I don't know how many people, let's say 60 or so. You know, we're special, okay, but outside in San Francisco, there's so many people who didn't come. Don't quite understand why not, but we didn't. No, we could think, well, we are special, but they're not special. You know, and that again seems to be part of the left tradition. But once we say that, then we're finished. Once we say that, then the only way in which we can think about revolution or radical change is as an elitist movement. Once we say we are special, then we are actually enclosing ourselves into an elitist concept of social change, or else just a complete pessimism. No. And the most exciting and the most difficult and the most challenging thing that the Zapatistas say, to come back to them again, is they say, we are ordinary people. We are perfectly ordinary women and men, children and old people, and that is why we are rebellious. And that seems to be amazingly challenging. They're not saying we're ordinary indigenous people in the southeast of Mexico. Okay, they're not saying that. They won't let you away with any romanticism. It's not them, it's not the indigenous, it's not these people who look a little bit different and to live in the heat who are now are going to be savers. No, they're not saying that. They're saying we are ordinary people. And that means the challenge then is that to try and think that means that not just looking at the person beside you in the room and thinking, oh, well, they're here tonight, it's because they're rebels too. It means going out and going out to the street afterwards and trying to see the rebellion inside people. And it means going to the shops or going to the supermarket the next time you go and seeing that quiet, perhaps old man there choosing his cornflakes or whatever, and recognizing the rebelliousness in them. And if we can't do that, then we're lost. And that's the real challenge, it seems to me. And if we start at that, if we think then that, okay, our challenge, we are revolting. And the challenge of thinking of our revolt or our rebelliousness as being ordinary is also the challenge of dignity, which is really the challenge of the mutual recognition of dignities. Okay, because if we just say, well, we're dignity, not the people outside, poor masses. No? We are dignity. If we just say that, then it's nonsense. I mean, the very notion of dignity means trying to recognize the dignity of ordinary people. It means trying to recognize the rebelliousness of ordinary people. It means trying to see, or trying to find, I suppose, a practical recognition of dignity, which leads us then to a certain concept of politics. It must lead us to a certain concept of politics, because then it means that we're trying to think of political organization in a way that will articulate dignities. Mm. And that seems to me a tremendous, if we think of the whole anti-capitalist tradition, we've really got to, within the whole anti-capitalist movement, right back to the beginning, we've really got two sorts of ways of thinking about it, and two sorts of ways of thinking about organization. And the one tradition, of course, is the tradition of councils, of assemblies, of Soviets, the tradition that in order to move forward, we have to try and, in order to move forward against and beyond this world which denies our dignity, which denies our subjectivity, we have to be able to build forms of organization that expresses that which is negated in the actual world. In other words, we have to build forms of organization that allow people to articulate their dignities, that encourage people to speak, that encourage people to explain their worries, that encourage people to talk about their concerns, that encourage people to draw out their dignity. And that, I think that's been the fantastic thing, surely, about the whole Occupy movement and the whole Indignados movement and the whole movement in North Africa and in all over the place, really, the last a couple of years ago, at least, is that it was an overwhelming movement of assemblyism. It is a really revival of that tradition of councilism, which seems to be enormously important. And the other tradition, of course, the other tradition is to think, well, if we want to bring about change, then we must think instrumentally. We must think, well, we must think of the most effective way of bringing about changes, at least in the short term. Therefore, we must enter into the power structures established by society. We must, in other words, get involved with state. The state, or we must think of political parties, we must think of at least of political pressure groups, which means we try and think of going into the state in order to bring about the change. And that means getting involved in forms of organization that are hierarchical, getting involved in forms of organization that deny, that run counter to the mutual recognition of dignities. And it may well be that those forms of organization can bring about changes in the short term, or at least small changes, but they don't actually break the dynamic of the society in which we live. They don't break the dynamic of death. So I think you can actually think, if you like, a contrast between the politics of dignity and the politics of poverty. Politics of poverty, on the whole, starts, as I said a few minutes ago, not from richness. Well, richness starts from the poor. You know, okay, here we are, here in the university institution, we are normally, okay, we're not desperately poor normally. But outside, yes, I mean, outside, it's amazing. It's really been hitting me all day today, the amount of poverty in the streets. It's just appalling. And then you begin to think, well, yes, of course we have to change that. We have to change society on behalf of the poor. And then you get into, it seems to me, a different logic, a different way of thinking about social change, a different way of thinking about radical change. You get into a thinking, you get into to a politics of poverty, which may achieve things. I mean, I think you could argue that in Venezuela, Bolivia, perhaps, yeah, even possibly in Brazil, Argentina, yes, it has achieved changes. But it also reproduces the whole system, because once you think of people as poor, if you think of people for politics of poverty, then you're trying to change things on behalf of people. In other words, you're making them the object of your action. And the problem with that is that very often people say, well, fine, yes, we don't actually want to be the object of what you think. So I think it's very important to make that distinction between a politics of poverty and the politics of dignity, and they really lead us in different directions. Nobody wants to interrupt me, actually. Okay, I'll go on. The other thing about us, I think, is that we exist in, against, and beyond this society. We exist in this society because, yeah, this is where we live. This is actually where we have to survive. This is where we have to find a way of making a living, a way of reproducing ourselves, of looking after the people we love. And we also exist against it because we know what an awful society it is. We know what a disaster it is. So we exist in and against the society. And we also exist beyond, because all the time what we're trying to do is to create ways of relating to other people that don't follow the logic of money, that don't follow the capitalist pattern. We're trying to do something else. We're trying to walk in the wrong direction. We're trying to say, no, that's not right. We're going to do something else. We're going to create something else, that walking in the wrong direction can be all sorts of things. Can be organizing talks on anti-capitalism. It can try to be trying to teach students to be critical. It can be creating different relations with the plants and other forms of life that surround us. It can be creating gardens. It can be doing all sorts of things. And we have millions of ways of doing it. Okay. So I think all the time, this is something I'll come back to later on, you said the cracks, I suppose, all the time we're creating cracks in the logic of the system that dominates us. But if we're creating cracks, that also means that we are self-antagonistic, because we don't live just beyond the society. We don't live in some kind of after-capitalist heaven, unfortunately. You know, we actually live in this society, and we live also against it. We try and create something else, which means that we are inevitably self-antagonistic. Because we are inevitably, in some sense, turned against ourselves. That we are inevitably schizophrenic in the popular sense of being self-divided, not in the clinical sense. That we are, and this means, I think, that if we start thinking of that, then one notion goes out the window completely, and that is the notion of revolutionary purity. We can, the notion of revolutionary purity, the notion that we are correct, but those other poor ignoramuses over there don't know how to do things properly. Once we start with that, then we destroy ourselves. You know, that's the great, another of the great left traditions, isn't it? Let's all kill ourselves through sectarianism. You know, we don't have to, the police really don't come into it very much. We can destroy ourselves perfectly well, thank you. No. But once you think, you know, that inevitably, if we say, well, what we do, our dignity, the very fact that we live dignity against the denial of dignity means inevitably that we are self-contradictory. Once we think that, then okay, we can say, well, yes, we don't have the perfect answer. You know, they don't either. Those people over there don't either. You know, and we can certainly criticize them. We can certainly say, well, you know, we don't agree with the way you're going. We think it'd be much more effective to go some other way. But we cannot criticize them from the point of view of correctness. We can only criticize them from the point of view of trying to find more effective or better ways of expressing our repudiation of the system. So we are self-contradictory, and we are self-contradictory as well. And this seems to me, I'm sorry, I keep on saying this seems to me important. I am saying this seems to me important because it does seem to me important. It is actually that we rebel because we misfit. And the dictionary tells me that misfit is a noun, not a verb, but too bad for the dictionary. We actually misfit, we don't fit in. You know, if we're here tonight, it's because we have some sense of misfitting. You know, we misfit, we don't fit in to the classifications, we don't fit in to the patterns that capitalism seems to put foot in us. No. And again, if we go back to the first sentence of Capital, where wealth appears in capitalist society as an immense collection of commodities, it seems to me that Marx is saying wealth doesn't fit into that. It's true that it does, but the commodification of wealth is a structural misfitting, if you like. The commodification of wealth, or the whole idea is to think that the commodity or the capital is a Procrustean bed. It's one that forces us into a certain shape. Only it doesn't work. It doesn't work because if it did work, we would be incapable of seeing that was what was happening. So we can squelch or we fall out over the edges of this rack or bed in one way or another. We misfit. This is what constitutes, in a way, our dignity, what constitutes our rebelliousness, is that we don't fit into the classifications, that we don't fit in to, and we don't fit in, we're misfits, not because we're weirdos necessarily, we're misfits because capitalism misfits us, because capitalism forces us into shapes in which we cannot fit. So we are kind of necessarily misfitting. And that again, means, I think, that we are anti-identitarian. Means that we don't fit into identities. And of course, I suppose, I don't know if identity politics started in San Francisco, I suspect that it did. But the problem with identity politics is that it tries to fit it into classifications. We don't. We don't fit in, and it's fundamentally important to say we don't fit in. But the basis of our dignity, the basis of our rebelliousness is that we don't fit into classifications. We don't fit into little boxes. We can say, as I think the Zapatistas do, we are indigenous, but more than that. We can say we are gay, but more than that. Or we are women, but more than that. Or we are Irish, but more than that. But if we don't say that, but more than that, then I think that it becomes reactionary. It becomes a conservative statement. It becomes the creation of a new category. And capital, I think, has absolutely no problems with creating spaces for new boxes. No problem at all. What capital cannot cope with is actually the overflowing, the kind of going beyond categories, the misfitting, the conscious misfitting, which says, yes, we misfit and we are proud of it. We misfit. We are anti-identitarian and therefore anti-institutional as well, because institutionalization seems to be a kind of a way of classifying, a way of closing. You know, there's this debate going on at the moment about, well, what should the left be doing, or what should the what anti-global, you know, that us, what should we be doing after the whole waves of movements over the last few years, and there's an argument, what we should think in terms of creating new institutions. And I don't think that's right. I think that actually we are not. Our movement, our being, well, our doing is a pushing against institutionalization. Oh, there's a clock over there. Okay, I'll carry on. I might do it, please interrupt me, but if you don't, I'll carry on for hours, probably.
John, if I may?
Yes!
I'm wondering, it's fascinating. I have to say, your presentation is fascinating, very compelling. And there seems to me that there's a spiritual implication to this that I'm not, you know, I don't want to get you off on a tangent or disrupt the flow or the direction of your comments, but
hello.
Yep.
So I'll start again. It seems that at some level there's a spiritual implication, or there's an implication around spirituality, maybe. You know, the sort of immateriality of the way you're presenting this politics, and I'm wondering if you've thought about that, or am I getting it wrong?
I don't know if you're getting it wrong, but I haven't really thought about it. I don't really think of it in that way, I suppose. Let's come back to it later, I think. Any other interruptions? Or
guys?
Yeah.
Thank you for the concept of we. It is very compassionate and a wonderful idea. In my life, I've always found that to be something I must earn before I use it. Otherwise, it's a very dangerous illusion that leads to inaction. And I'm always, whether this is in Selma in 65 or in front of the Pentagon in 67,
okay.
Before we say the word we must go inside ourselves and force ourselves to earn that, like the Zapatistas did. And do you have any comments about that?
Wouldn't say earn. I think the we is something that has to be built in practice. Yes, we is not just we. has to be based on some sort of concept of doing, I think. Whether it means going inside ourselves, I don't know. I mean, yes, going inside ourselves. I suppose part of the idea that we are self-contradictory means that changing the world means changing ourselves. And in that sense, any kind of radical action is also an action against ourselves. I don't know. We'll come back again later.
I disagree that you say answer not in this category with us with these struggles, because they fight and die too, and they momentarily become brothers and sisters in a way, or sexually amorphous little motherfuckers, and they become involved by smelling themselves and momentarily know themselves to be free by smelling themselves. We kind of do that too. So that's something about. Something about more determinate and chemical things in life, and at that feeling. Smelling themselves.
Okay, I confess I hadn't thought about it in those terms.
It's all good.
But okay, I'll carry on.
Yeah, I got a question. What you're saying sounds good, but it's kind of nebulous, and I hate to be a downer.
Kevin, do you want to use this?
Oh, yeah, sure. I hate to be a downer, but in any struggle for liberatory social change, we ultimately come to the question of force. I mean, what you're saying reminds me about Marx when he was young. He supposedly sarcastically said that demands for liberty, equality, and fraternity would most likely be met by cavalry, infantry, and artillery. And in under democratic regimes, they're more sophisticated than that. It's not like an old-fashioned, historically obsolete, monarchical or fascist or Stalinist tyranny. You don't, throughout most advanced capitalist areas of the world, you don't see a lot of obvious, brutal repression keeping people in line, with the probable exception of the United States. But ultimately, I mean, a social movement in the 21st century that can abolish the capitalist mode of production and abolish market relations and wage labor and begin the long, difficult process of creating a society worthy of the human beings who live in it, it'll have to be so large and so self-aware that it can probably carry the most necessary social measures of the minimum of violence against other human beings, but not completely. Because capitalist social relations, they're crystallized in certain institutions and in certain harmful individuals. And again, I don't want to be a downer or sound like a Bordigist or something like that, but those individuals will have to be destroyed. And I'm against Lenin, I'm against Kautsky, and I'm against the Bolsheviks after March of 1918, but I'm reminded favorably of lines of Lenin from his letter of advice to the revolutionaries of Hungary in the spring of 1919. Lenin said to guys like Tibor Szamuly, among other things, he said, "From the beginning, the dictatorship of the proletariat must use swift, implacable, merciless revolutionary violence against exploiters, against capitalists, big landowners, and their minions, and anyone who does not understand that is not a revolutionary." On that one line, I do agree with Lenin. And I'm sorry, I don't want to derail what you're saying, because much of what, I mean, I like it, but there's the downside that has to be addressed, too.
Okay, I'm good. I think probably the next point I was going to make, I think, is that we don't have the answers. We don't know how to make a revolution. We are confused. Okay, to go back to the self-contradictory we. I mean, I think we have to start, if we're going to start talking about, which we are, of course, being here, we're talking about radical change and the possibilities of radical change and how to think about radical change. And I think that, are we okay with the microphone? Yeah? I think that one fundamental aspect of us is that we don't have the answers. We don't know. What we do know, I suppose, is that we have an experience of what revolution meant in the 20th century. You know, we see thousands and millions of people who devoted their lives to trying to create a better society, to trying to create a communist society. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people who died for us, who lived for it and then died for it. And I think we can now say it didn't work. You know, it didn't work. And in most cases, it was worse than not working. It was actually a disaster. You know, I assume that most of us here are really committed to the struggle against capitalism. But I would suspect that there are very few people in this room who feel, oh, if only I could have lived in the Soviet Union in the 1930s and 40s. And for it to have worked, we would have to feel that, and we don't. It was actually a disaster. That, you know, it was a disaster that probably, well, that arguably did more than anything else to actually stabilize capitalism in the 20th century. You know, so I suppose what happened, I mean, after the fall of the Soviet Union, was that people became embarrassed very often about talking about revolution or the need for revolution, which of course is complete nonsense, because capitalism becomes worse and worse and worse, more and more destructive. No. So we have to go back to the question, not of how we, just of how we can have our struggles here and there, but how can we actually break the system? How can we break this dynamic of destruction? And we know the answer. And we know that the only honest answer is we don't know. We don't know how to do it. We know that that failed. You know, we can say that, you know, we can explain it in different ways in different countries, of course. We can look at the details. We can say, well, Stalin, of course. We can say, you know, we can say, you know, we can explain China in one way, we can explain Russia in another way, we can explain Cuba, but Cuba's a bit different in another way, we can explain Albania in a different way. But the point for me, I think, is that we also have to draw general lessons. And I think what I would say is that there was something fundamentally wrong with the conception of revolution. And there was something fundamentally wrong with the idea that you could bring about the sort of radical change that we want through the state. And the reason that was wrong is because the state is not our form of organization. The state is a particular form of organization that excludes, that is hierarchical, that excludes people from the process of social determination. And the only way forward is to try and rethink how revolution can be made, how we can think about radical change. And the starting point for rethinking is to say, well, we don't actually have all the answers. I don't know what you do. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think the question of violence, the question of how we confront the use of physical force by the state is of enormous importance. I don't have any easy answer. I don't even have any difficult answer. I think I don't have an answer on just how you do it. But I'm saying, look, you have to really confront the issue. You have to think of what? If we think in terms of organizing ourselves for violence, then that has fundamental effects on the way we think about social change. We think the way we think about relations between one another has fundamental effects upon the relation we think about the way which we think about the relations between women and men, between young people and old people. To think in terms of armed revolution is really to think in terms of a movement dominated by young men. And that doesn't appeal to me very much. No. So I think if we say, start off by saying we don't know, it also takes us, for me, the important thing is that it takes us into a different sort of politics. Because if you say, well, we know how to do it, then, of course, our duty is to explain to the other people how to do it. You know, it takes you into a politics of monologue, of talking to the masses, of explaining to them. Whereas if you start off by saying, well, we don't actually know. You know, we're full of ideas, we're full of experiences, but we don't have the answers. Then that immediately takes you into a politics of dialogue. It means where you actually can say, yeah, I don't know, what do you think? How do you think we can do it? You know. So fair enough. And that, again, comes back in one of the kind of basic principles of the Zapatistas, is this idea of politics in terms of asking we walk. The way we move forward is by asking, by drawing people into discussion, asking them, getting them involved in an active discussion, an active process of listening and talking. And that, I think, is very important. I know you want to come back. Let me just go on and then we'll come back to it. So we're confused. We're in crisis. Also, it's kind of easy, I suppose. One thing that I've been thinking recently is it's easy to say, well, we know that the revolutions of the 20th century, or we know that state-centered politics doesn't seem to work very well. Doesn't seem to bring about the fundamental changes that we want. Therefore, you know, we have to think of a different kind of politics. But I think we also have to be aware that the current struggles in places like Greece and Spain also confront us with our own crisis. We have to say, well, look, in Greece, you've got this absolute, you've got, on the one hand, this appalling politics of austerity. On the other hand, you have the most militant tradition of struggle, both state-centered struggle and anarchistic and autonomous creative struggle certainly in Europe and, you know, among the most important traditions in the world. But they've been struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling and doing everything possible. But they haven't actually succeeded in breaking the dynamic of austerity. And I think we have to in some way think, well, that's our crisis too. That kind of confronts us with the limits of our own thinking. Okay. I think that's where we are. I could go on. I'm not going to go on. Let's talk. I know you want to come back. There was somebody there who wanted to come back.
Oh, wait. I can wait a long time. Everybody else should talk.
Yeah?
Yeah, I just have two comments. One is the eventual idea of communism and socialism, what I understand, was to do, they called it the withering away of the state. Mm-hmm. So they had this idea of the state was, in the long run, a bad actor, but maybe their error was seeing the transition through state power, and then they got stuck there. The other thing is the state provides many services to people, and things like health care in some states more than they do in this country. And in the idea of trans, and many of the very conservative, which I think in some ways many of us have something in common with, though we don't like to think that, they're nervous about the state as well.
Yeah.
Maybe for different reasons. And there are people who think that all good things come from the state. But in a transitional period, there are services and ways of living that really have to be centralized, or at least. So I just wanted you to comment on that kind of different way of looking at the any kind of transition.
Should we take interventions three by three?
Sure.
Perhaps we could just put that.
I just wanted to respond to that. There are all these services, but somehow
miraculously, when the state sets up those services, it does it in the most reactionary, demeaning way. So I think that points to the need for somehow, and I have no idea how, autonomous organizations or movements somehow supplying that need, not going through the organs of the state.
I want to know what an institution is, and what you understand by anti-institutional, and when an organization becomes an institution.
Okay, yeah, yes. Well, on the first two, which really go together, I suppose basically I agree with the second, with what you were saying. It does seem to me it's a very complicated thing. I think that if we think of healthcare, if we think of education, if we think of social services to help the poor, then, on the one hand, I suppose I spent, a lot of my life in Britain. In that sense, kind of grew up with the idea of the National Health Service. And it does seem to me that is just so important, the idea that you can go to a doctor and you don't have to think at all about money. No, you can go to hospital and you don't have to think all about money. So I appreciate that. On the other hand, if you think of what health means, what education means, what aid to the poor means, when administered by the state, then it is clear that it imposes certain concepts of health and well-being. It imposes certain concepts of education. It imposes certain concepts of mutual aid, I suppose, which is not mutual aid, it is state administered aid, which I think run counter to the sort of society that we would want to create. But on the other hand, I think precisely as the second, as the comrade there said, we do have to think very actively about just how we build other ways of dealing with these issues. Again, if you look, I keep on citing the Zapatistas, I don't really want to, it's just they come to mind all the time. There they've been building up over the last 20 years their own system of education, their own system of organization, of mutual support, of justice, of how you deal with criminals, etc. Which are very much embedded within the communities and come from them. I think that is, for me, part of the process of revolution that we have to think of. In other words, but I think that's what I would say. On the question of the withering of way of the state, I think, which was Engels in particular, I suppose I feel he got it wrong. I think that he got it wrong in the sense that I don't think that we can, if you think of the state as a specific form of social organization, the state is a way of doing things, it's a way of relating to people, it's a way of doing things that actually excludes people, like state education, in a sense, excludes the children, state medicine excludes the patients from the process. If you think of the state as a way of doing things, then you can say, well, no, because what we want is actually to create a different society in which things are done in different ways, and that is the only way we can build our strength. The third question on institutions, and what is an institution? I suppose what I think of as an institution is really an established our habitual way of doing things. So if we institutionalize a practice, supposing we say, you know, here this evening we are going to say, well, we'll all come back again tomorrow, and we'll all come back again the day after, and next week again at the same time on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and the week after that on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, then this may be a very appealing practice. It may be fine, but what I feel is that it gradually gets hollowed out. It gradually becomes a set of rules. It gradually loses its own force. It seems to me that assemblies, I mean, it's, if you think of assemblies, again, I think they can become institutionalized, but I think that for an assembly of life, it has to be something that people come to because they're enthusiastic about it. And when they're not, they'll stay away from it. In other words, that any kind of establishment of patterns is always an attempt to lay down what people in the future will do. And I think that that is generally harmful, not always harmful, but on the whole is not the way to think about the sort of change that we want to create. On the other hand, I do feel that in some ways, because of our own limitations, we need institutions, you know. I mean, I said, you know, here we're in an institution, aren't we, in the CIIS, and in this, the After Capitalism Program, right? I work in an institution as well in Pueblo, which, you know, which I like very much indeed. You know. I mean, I think that we do have a kind of tendency to fall into institutions, but in a way, we have to constantly move beyond them. We have to think beyond them. We have to think of moving on.
Thank you so much for coming to talk to us. I'm really enjoying your very honest reflections, and I think this is very, very important. Going back to the question of institutions and maybe connected to the question of transition, my concern with this discussion at the moment and thinking about, you know, creating autonomous organizations and whatnot, which I basically agree with, but I'm also very concerned about, because this is the same exact motto of neoliberalism, the whole idea of the destruction of public education and also of faith-based initiatives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the idea that we want to flush the state down the drain because the government is not the solution, it's the problem, the famous Reagan, blah, blah, blah. And so my question here is, of course, we all do know that, but issues, how do we, you know, confront this issue that way back the Greeks already were confronted with the Kopisha of Ananken, freedom and necessity, you know, it's what you just said a moment, structure and anti-structure, and so how can we proceed? Because if we lose some of the elements, that as bad as the state may be, at least some states, there was an accumulation of social knowledge and wealth and possibility that if we destroyed completely, we're going back to feudal times and to the lords and the ladies, and so to the Lady Thatcher.
Yeah, I want to go back to the question of the we, which I think is such an important pronoun in our time, because I'm seeing a lot of the invocation of the we in the climate crisis currently, and it's being invoked, I think, by scientists with the best of intentions in a very undifferentiated way. By scientists say, we are in trouble, we are destroying the planet, and what I feel it needs to be stated is, well, some of us are destroying the planet more than others, some nation states, some corporations. So the problem is how to differentiate the we, how to break up that we, which I see very, you know, it captures the imagination, because we want to, our best aspirations is to think of the we as a species, or perhaps even beyond a species, as sentient beings, or any kind of being on the planet. And so the problem with the we always is who's outside of the we. In this case, environmentally, I feel like there needs to be stated that we, you know, we don't, those who are advocating climate adaptation, spaceship Earth, which is really Fortress Europe, Fortress US, that's not the we that I want to subscribe to any more than universal humanity under the regime of empire was a humanity that was inclusive. So I'm just quite wondering how to think about the we that you want to invoke in the context of this we of the scientists and environmentalists and of climate adapters.
One more.
I'd like to ask about dialogue. It's very critical, very important. Can you give us some advice on your experiences, how you accomplished meaningful dialogue with people like Zapatistas and others? It would be very helpful, I think. Thank you.
Yeah, on the first one about the first question about neoliberalism, which really goes back to one of your questions, which I hadn't answered properly, about what about the right wing, the ultra conservative attacks on the state? You know, which really comes together. And Mrs. Thatcher. I mean, I think if we think, you know, of the bits of the state that we don't perhaps hate as much as other bits of the state, you know, then I think we have to say, yes, those, if we think of, again, okay, I mean, I suppose I'll think, relate back to my British experience of the welfare state, no? And including the National Health Service, the education system, the fact that at least when I was a student, of course you didn't pay in the universities, and of course you received a grant to go to universities, and everybody did, everybody who got into the universities. And fantastic. And you can say, well, look, that really a lot of the 20th century was dominated, I suppose, by the push to drive back the rule of money, no? To push back, to struggle against the rule of the commodity, the push against the commodification of absolutely everything. No? And you can think of the revolutions in Russia and China and the other places really as attempts to break commodification, as to push back the rule of money. And amazing, you know, tremendously important. You can think also of the whole social democratic movement, I think, as part of the drive to push back the rule of money. Okay? And yes, great, you know, people fought and fought and fought for these changes, and they have to be respected. And then you can say, well, yes, but of course, what happened to those struggles was that they were reformed by the state. They were given a different form. Okay, so that the way the struggles were were expropriated from the people who were struggling for them. Okay, so that the education, the state education that came out wasn't actually a people, wasn't an education dominated by the people. No. And you can understand, you know, the reaction, of course, of people against that as well. You know, the experience of state education in very many cases is a very unpleasant experience. No. It doesn't actually allow, you know, if we think of our richness in terms of the richness of our creativeness, that was the point about the quotation from the Grotius at the beginning. If you think of that, no, education doesn't allow that kind of richness to expand and develop. No. Okay, so if then these statified responses to real social struggles are attacked as they were as they are attacked by neoliberalism. What do we do? I think what we do is to say, well, look, no, we really want the we have to fight for the decommodification of education, we have to push back the rule of money. We have to, in a way, start from, perhaps, where that push against the rule of money got to, and say, yeah, but we have to take it further, and we have to drive it further and further. And that to this really comes on to Eddie's question. Just a footnote, I think, on what you were saying as well about the right. One thing that seems to me we have to do, that we don't, at least I haven't seen that really seriously discussed, is we're all into rethinking the left. But we're not really rethinking the whole concept of the right and what we mean by the right. And I think we need to. We need to see that in the same way in which the left is contradictory, we need as well to rethink the concept of the right. I don't know what the implications of that are, it just seems to be important. Okay. What I would say is that the core of the problem with state institutions, this really comes to Eddie's very, very difficult question about the we. What I think is that we have to think if the we, what I said a moment ago is that the we is sort of contradictory because we exist in and against the current society. I also talked about our richness, about our dignity. The way that I was trying to say that the fundament, the kind of basis in which all of these things are founded is actually our creative power, our power to do, our power to create. Okay, if we think that the basis of capitalism, is that it takes our doing, our creative power, and it abstracts it, or that it draws it into a form of social cohesion that we do not control. Okay. It takes our richness, the richness of our creative capacities, and through the operation of money or through the commodity, it kind of pulls it into a system so that our creative abilities, our richness, are kind of being dragged into a form that we don't control. Okay. This means that we experience, I suppose if you think of the basis of what we are, not if we think of ourselves not as human beings but as human doers, in other words, what makes us human is our doing, is our activity, is our ability to think about our activity, to project our ability to work cooperatively. If you think of that, then the loss of that ability to control our own doing, okay, is the fundamental criticism of capitalism. Okay, if we think of capitalism, we start off thinking of dignity, thinking about richness, then we're thinking of capitalism really as a system of frustration. Before exploitation, the problem of capitalism is that it frustrates us. It doesn't allow us to develop our richness. It doesn't allow us to develop our doing, our creative capacity. So that our creative capacity is drawn into this system, but not entirely, because if it were entirely drawn in, then we wouldn't be able to talk about it. Okay. And Marx talks about that. Again, one right at the beginning of Capital, he says that the key thing, the key to understanding everything about capitalism is the dual nature of labor, the antagonism, if you like, between our concrete labor, our ability to do things, our ability to create our own projects or worlds, and abstract labor, which is abstract or alienated labor, the labor that we are drawn into, where that creative capacity is taken away from us. Okay. But we have to say, again, by saying, starting off by talking about dignity, but start talking about we, but talking about richness. We're saying yes, but not entirely. That our creative ability is not entirely lost within the capitalist system. We overflow from that. We go beyond. We exist beyond that. And that is precisely what we are trying to do here. We're trying to create something that doesn't follow the logic of capital. That's what you're trying to do in CIS, trying to do in so many projects, in so many creative things here and all over the world, is that we're actually moving beyond. We're trying to create something that doesn't fit in. Okay. So that, to go on to Eddie's question about the we, that is the thing. The we is a we that says we are dispossessed and we will take the world that is ours. That's the great thing about the Occupy movements. It's not just that they're going and putting up tents and squares here and there. They're saying, we are occupying the world because the world is ours. And how dare they take it away from us? And that's the point for me of starting with dignity and richness, is that you're starting with this idea that the world is ours. It is ours to create. And if you pose we in those terms, then I think you're saying that we is the fundament, that we is creating a self-determining process of doing, of creativity, which goes against money, which is the negation of our possibility of self-creation. And there is your distinguishing line. We don't have to say, they're the baddies, we're the goodies. Because once you get into that, it seems to be disastrous. No, you have to say, we means a way of doing. They don't have that way of doing. No. If they want to give up being chief executives and whatever and come and join us in building a community garden, fine. It's not necessarily that, we hate them as individuals. What we hate is their way of organizing things, their way of subjecting our activity to a certain logic, to a logic of destruction. That's very important as well. If we think back to you mentioned the dictatorship of the proletariat, and Panikuk criticized Lenin for his concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and he said, well, the problem with Lenin is that he thinks that the dictatorship of the proletariat, he thinks of it in personal terms, so that those people are not proletarians, so that they have to be eliminated. But Panikuk says, no, it's not about that, it's about the way that we organize. And if we organize on the basis of factory councils, then we find that the capitalists just don't come along. They're going to be eliminated from that process. If we think of organization in terms of assemblies, then that itself is a process of exclusion. That itself is the way in which the we becomes defined. Okay. So really the fundamental, the basis of it all is really this question of how we think the basis of it all, the basis of dignity and the basis of richness and the basis of self-contradiction and the basis of, I think, everything else I said, is really to understand ourselves as the movement of doing against labor. Okay? The movement of the doing that comes from us. We do what we think is desirable or necessary or enjoyable, but not because of the logic that is imposed upon us by money and by profit. Okay, so the we is really the movement of that. It's the movement of doing against labor. And if you think of all these projects, and if you think of all these movements, if you think of tonight, if you think of the CIIS, if you think of what we're trying to do in Puebla. If you think of the Zapatistas, if you think of the uprisings all over the place, then this is precisely it. It is the same people saying, well, we will shape what we think is right. We will not shape our lives according to the logic of money. And that, for me, is the composition of the we. The movement of the we that goes composing, you know, I suppose that is your earning as well, isn't it? I mean, what you were saying earlier, but, you know, we need to earn the we need to earn the we, and, or we not earn, but we need to create the we through some sort of, through the processes of cooperation that go against the logic of money, to try and recapture or reoccupy the doing. Which sounds, I mean, I don't want it to sound abstract. I mean, but the danger of all that I've been saying is that it may sound abstract. In fact, it's not. It's actually what the movements are saying. It is what is happening. If you actually look at the anti-capitalist movements over the last 20, 30 years, they've been developing new concepts. They've been developing the we. They've been developing, I suppose what they've been developing above all, is this idea that we can't just think of exploitation. We can't just think of our struggle against capitalism as being a struggle against exploitation. Yes, of course, that's part of it. But exploitation is the basis of a whole system of social cohesion, a whole system that pulls us all together in a way that destroys us, destroys us personally, and destroys our possibilities of creation, and is destroying us as a society. So the problem is not just exploitation. It's not just a question of working class against capitalist caste, but the problem is how we break this system of social cohesion. And the system of social cohesion is established through money, but the basis behind that is actually is established through the abstraction of doing into labor. And I think that is actually what is happening, where the we arises from. This is a big, you know, why people are reluctant very often to talk about the working class. I think, in fact, if we think of our movement as the movement of doing against labor, then we have to say our movement, yes, is the people, is really the movement of doers who are forced to labor against that labor. So it is a working class movement against work in the sense of alienated labor and against being classified. That's what the struggle of the working class is about. But it's really a protest. Yeah, if we're talking then about this homeless upsurge of struggle, it's really about how you break that system of cohesion. And rather than thinking, once you say, well, the secret isn't to take power, the secret is really the challenge, and I think this is what's being said, but it's also extremely problematic, is how do we uncouple ourselves? How do we break away from the system of social cohesion? How, even within the existing society, how do we develop forms of doing things that push in the other direction, that make sense, and that can be possible embryos of a future society? And I think that's what's happening, and I think that's also, I mean, I don't know whether you're all into reading Capital. You should be, you must be. But it's also leading to a kind of reinterpretation, I think, of Capital, where people are beginning to move from the chapters on exploitation and focus more on the question of value and the way in which capitalism can be seen as this, in the first place, as this system of social cohesion. For the system of social cohesion, which at the same time is not a system of social cohesion, because the only way we can talk about it as a system of social cohesion is if we ourselves are bursting out of it, if we ourselves are bursting beyond it. No? And that's what dignity is about. It's about saying, well, we won't follow the rules of the game. It's about saying, well, we will create, and we are our dignity means that we are creators, our dignity means that we are doers, Our dignity means that we will not just follow the logic of the system. We will create other things. We will create other spaces. We will create other times. And so I think that's how we have to think about the we. But of course, you're completely right that we can be used in kind of very loose ways, but somehow we have to pin it down and say that we mean self-determination of our social self-determination of our own doing, of our own creativity. And that's what people are already saying, although for the press. Oh, the question about meaningful dialogue, I think that's part of the same thing, actually. I think it's really that the meaningful dialogue is really this process of liberating our doing, and part of that, of course, is liberating our own doing, our talking. No?
Okay, it's already 9 o'clock, so we have to end for tonight. But John is going to be back tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. The topic for tomorrow is social cohesiveness of capital, something that strangles us, right? And finally, the last topic, which is going to be on Thursday, is?
I think it's We Are the Crisis of Capital.
Sounds beautiful.